Blog Talk Radio.
Up for you. Jeb Bush is so desperate that he is calling on his brother. Oh, that's so sad. But you know what the even crazier thing is? I mean, it might not even be all that sad because we discussed how George Bush has made a comeback in Republican circles. That's not, you know, that's not some sort of conspiracy. There's polling on it. It's amazing that he did, but he did. I guess Jeb Bush caught wind of that being the case, so he called up his brother and said, "Hey, man, you want to campaign for me?" Crazy stuff. We're going to kick it off with that in just a second. We have President Obama basically saying, how about we escalate to more war in Syria and Iraq? They already, as you guys know, we did the reports, but they already did that with Afghanistan. Why not go for the other two as well? So President Obama, the anti-war candidate, is now probably going to finish his time in office with more wars going on than George W. Bush, his predecessor, had. Way to go there, buddy. Then we have yet another hospital bombing. I can't. We have an incredible story about a big pharma CEO who's letting it all hang out there and explaining the way the system works. Spoiler alert, it's not to fucking help you. And then later on, climate change is getting so bad that there are some areas in the Middle East that are donezo. The temperatures that it will hit in how many years? About 100 years or so? It's going to be flat out uninhabitable. Incredible stuff. And Ken Ham, the creationist, is swinging against Bill Nye yet again because, you know, he had the debate with him on evolution recently and he decided why not go after him on the issue of climate change as well. So that's adorable. We'll discuss that and much more. So let's kick it off here with Jeb Bush and what's going on in his campaign. Jeb Bush is now officially desperate. His campaign has reached out to George W. Bush for help. Couldn't make it up if I tried. Reuters reports, quote, Jeb has played down his famous family roots in his pursuit of the 2016 Republican presidential nomination, but with his campaign in trouble, he turned on Monday to George W. Bush for a political morale boost. The former president appeared on stage with his younger brother before an important gathering of Bush donors in Houston, an event that the Bush team sought to use to calm down jittery supporters alarmed by his months-long slide in the polls. They continue, the Houston event was George W. Bush's first public campaign appearance for his brother, who was seeking the Republican nomination for the November 16th presidential election. It marked a shift from Jeb Bush's use of his brother strictly for closed-door fundraising events. Since many of Jeb Bush's financial supporters were also backers of the two other Bush presidents and hold them in high regard, the presence of George W. Bush and their father, George H.W. Bush, at the two-day Houston event was a major selling point. So oftentimes I joke around and I say, you know, the only reason any of the donors even consider Jeb is that they know that the entire Bush family are sellouts, and they know that they can trust the Bush family because they trusted H.W., they trusted W., and those guys, for all their faults, and they have many, and this is also a fault, they gave the donors what they wanted. I mean, whatever the corporations want, whatever Wall Street wants, go right ahead. It's all yours. So now what our suspicion was has been proven. They're like, yeah, even when we do public events, it's just big money donors, and it's big money donors who are supporting Jeb for corrupt reasons. And now they're just flying that flag high. They're like, yeah, that's what we're about. And the rest of the country, the majority of the country, I should say, does not look at George W. Bush in a positive light. This little closed-door event, and now at some events that aren't even closed-door, in that bubble, they're willing to trot out George W. Bush and say, oh, remember the good old days when this guy was giving us everything we wanted? Well, Jeb will do the same thing, so let's back him up. Guys, how sad is it? It's the saddest thing I've ever heard, that you have to go, you're so unpopular that you have to go to the president who had the subprime mortgage crisis happen on his watch, had the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil ever on his watch, who got us into two wars, didn't pay for it, put it on the credit card, gave us the Great Recession, and was a failure in almost every single measurable area. But they're like, oh my God, Jeb is so not interesting, and he's garnering so little support that it's better to go to this guy who has a track record of disaster. Now, as we discussed before, there's some new polls that show George W. bouncing back in the minds of the Republican base, but that just goes to show you how disconnected the Republican base is from the rest of the country and from normal people. I mean, really, that's who you're going to go to? You're going to go to George W. Bush. Can't believe, like, how pathetic is the Jeb campaign? Like, you're that pathetic? You're that uninteresting? I mean, you would think that they could come up with some sort of a strategy that somehow can kneecap, you know, the surge of people like Ben Carson or Donald Trump. Like, play into his strengths, play down his weaknesses. But they're like a chicken with their fucking head cut off. They don't know what they're doing. They're like, I don't know. All they could think of is raise more money from the big money donors. And they're actually partially right about that that's the only way he has any chance of winning. He's not going to win based off his charisma because he doesn't have any. So what do they have to do? They have to go to the big money donors and say, you need to keep giving us more and more money, and then that'll give us an opportunity maybe to pull it like 3% and then maybe hold on until the end. But this goes to show you a tremendous disconnect. I mean, compare somebody like Jeb fucking Bush and what he's doing now, and compare that to like Barack Obama in 2008. Now, whatever you think of Barack Obama governing, that's a separate conversation. But in terms of the genuine grassroots support that a guy like Obama was able to get when running, I mean, it's obvious that he had that flair that people like. He actually connected with people, and his message resonated to a certain extent. And obviously, coming off of the Bush years, people thought, oh my God, this is fantastic. So Jeb Bush comes along, and there's nothing redeeming about him. Nothing redeeming about him. I mean, most people, given the fucking blank check from the donors, most people could do all right. But Jeb has just been sliding. As we said yesterday, this is Jeb Bush's campaign. That noise represents Jeb Bush's campaign. He's just fucking wallowing into nothingness. It's so sad, man. You had to go to George W. Bush. His whole fucking campaign, he had a campaign poster that said, Jeb with an exclamation mark. Why? Because they wanted to distance themselves from, we're not George, not George W. But then the more time went on, the more he said in interviews, like, yeah, I mean, yeah, George was kind of right about Iraq, George was kind of right about this, George was kind of right about that. And then now they're like, fuck it, just trot him out there, he's more popular than us anyway. God, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard. George W. is significantly more popular than you, and you're running for president right now. Well, we'll see, man. I mean, the Republican base, they've proven over and over that they're also disconnected from reality. So, I mean, is it possible in one way or another that he can do what the original guess was, that he can hang in there until the end? Yeah, that's still a possibility. But it's becoming less and less of a possibility as time goes on, because he's not showing signs of life in the polls. Like, at least with other people, they've showed signs of life at different times, whether it's Carly Fiorina or whether it's John Kasich after the first debate. This is just like, you know, like I said, wallowing away into nothingness to the point where you have to trot out George W. Bush, the disaster. If Jeb makes it through the primary, which at this point he likely won't, do you have any idea the campaign ads I would run against them for this? Oh my God, it would be brutal. That's the guy you're gonna fucking have campaign for you? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I'd throw up economic numbers on the screen. Do you want another term of this? Or the fucking crash that he brought us, the wars. I'd go to work on that. All right, now, speaking of wars, can't give Obama a pass for that because pretty bad. The Washington Post is reporting that the Obama administration is considering getting more involved in Iraq and Syria. So recently we discussed how the U.S. upped our role in Afghanistan and they said we're going to stay there now through the end of Obama's term. And now we're considering, well, maybe we should do that in Iraq and Syria. They say, quote, Obama's most senior national security advisors have recommended measures that would move U.S. troops closer to the front lines in Iraq and Syria, a sign of mounting White House dissatisfaction with progress against the Islamic State and a renewed Pentagon push to expand military involvement in long-running conflicts overseas. The debate over the proposed steps, which would, for the first time, position a limited number of special operations forces on the ground in Syria and put U.S. advisors closer to the firefights in Iraq, comes as Defense Secretary Ashton B. Carter presses the military to deliver new options for greater military involvement in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. The changes would represent a significant escalation of the American role in Iraq and Syria. All right, so let's stop and think about this here. In other words, the people who are part of the military establishment, the Pentagon, military advisors, and people like that, they are now pressing Obama and others in the administration to up our role in Iraq and Syria. And perhaps one of the main reasons they're doing it is they saw that President Obama essentially buckled when it came to Afghanistan, and he said, yeah, okay, let's keep people there longer, and we're going to keep them there even, you know, through the time where I'm leaving office. So his end the war, he didn't fulfill it. He did the opposite. He's keeping troops there. So now they see, okay, we got a green light here. He's open to it. He's open to more military solutions. Let's give him more for the other areas and the other conflicts. Now think about the problem with that. The problem with that is the Pentagon and military experts, military officials, have historically always said more military is the answer. More war is the answer. More bombing is the answer. More involvement is the answer. And historically, they've been wrong most of the time. I mean, take Vietnam, for example. Lyndon B. Johnson, if he didn't escalate the war in Vietnam, he would have had a decent presidency. I mean, people after the fact now can look back and say, well, he did a guns and butter policy, which means, okay, he did social spending, he did the war on poverty, he did stuff like that, which was good, but then he also increased and escalated the war in Vietnam, which was an epic disaster because, of course, it was unwinnable and it was a giant quagmire. But what happened? See, LBJ listened to all the military advisors who kept telling him, increase, increase, increase. JFK did the same thing. This idea that, you know, JFK, oh, a great anti-war president, bullshit. He increased our role in Vietnam. So now we're seeing the same thing today with President Obama. He's not standing strong and being principled and saying, no, I said I was going to end these wars. I'm going to end these wars. All of the bullshit rationalizations to stay there, all of the threats credible and not in the region, now he's listening to it. He's going, well, you know, I mean, Iraq was a disaster after we pulled out from certain areas and ISIS came up. So maybe we need to prevent that from happening with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Maybe we need to prevent a worse situation from unfolding in Syria. But what he's not getting and what all these people are not getting is that the region is already broken. So now, by definition, whenever you pull out, which eventually you're going to pull out unless you want to stay there forever, which is crazy, it's going to go to shit. So the problem was getting involved in the first place. Now, each area is a little bit different, clearly. So when you talk about a place like Syria, there was a civil war that came about there. So obviously you can't fully blame all the problems on the United States of America. That would be ridiculous. Iraq is a different case. Afghanistan is a different case. We can go on and discuss each one individually. But the bottom line is, more intervention ain't going to fix it. And to take the opposite position at this point means you're ignorant or stupid. There's no other way to describe it because, I mean, just go back to the beginning of the war on terror and fast forward to today. They said at the beginning of the war on terror, our goal is to limit or eliminate terrorism, and specifically this kind of terrorism, al-Qaeda, jihadism, stuff like that. What happened since we began the war on terror? That's increased. So it's been an abject failure. It's been a measurable failure. Same thing with the war on drugs. I always draw this analogy because it's true. They waged a war on drugs. They said, oh, this is going to make us that we limit or eliminate the amount of drug use going on. What happened? The exact opposite. More people are doing drugs now than before the war on drugs. There's also 60,000 people that died on the border in a literal drug war because it's a war. You've also made the drug gangs more powerful. So the exact opposite of what you wanted to happen happened. It's the same thing with these military interventions. But President Obama is just, you know, mushy leader he is like, oh, my military advisors disagree. They want to do more military solutions. I'm listening to it. Of course they want to do more military solutions. That's their fucking job. You know, I hate to draw such a silly parallel here, but I used to watch the show House when it was on. It's obviously not on anymore. And I remember one time they were having a conversation where they say, and people in medicine will tell you that this actually happens in real life too. Whatever expert you go to for a problem you have, they will read in what their expertise is to the situation. So if you go to, you know, somebody who's an expert in a specific kind of cancer and they listen to your symptoms, they're going to go, it's cancer. You go to somebody else who's an expert in autoimmune diseases, they're going to hear the same set of symptoms and go, autoimmune. Because that's what they know. That's their specialty. So, and it's the same thing. Oh, a military advisor has told you that there's a military solution to the area where we've been doing military actions for over a decade. Yeah, I'm willing to listen. Well, don't. They're wrong. It's been proven, but it doesn't matter because President Obama is willing to buckle and is so scared of, oh, something worse that'll happen that, you know, he's not standing strong on his original position of ending the wars, which was the correct position. And then here's my favorite part of the article. Quote, the biggest problem facing Carter and Obama is that the increase in American military commitment would be unlikely to produce any major changes to the political situations in Iraq and Syria that have given rise to the Islamic State. So even in the article, they're like, well, no matter what we do, it's fucked. Okay, then why the fuck are you staying there and wasting our tax dollars and, unfortunately, sometimes killing more civilians, creating more terrorists? They say, in Iraq, the United States is fighting the Islamic State alongside Shiite militias, some of which are backed by Iran. Just across the border in Syria, Iran-backed Shiite militias are fighting in support of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who is barrel-bombing civilians and battling the moderate rebel, so-called moderate rebel groups that the United States is supporting. Obama has said that Assad, who depends on Iranian and Russian military backing for his regime's survival, must go for there to be any hope of peace. Okay, so understand what they're saying there, because this shows you how the U.S. really is playing the village idiot in the Middle East. What they're saying is, in Iraq, we're on the side of the Shiite militias. Why? Because those are the people who are fighting ISIS. So that makes sense, right? Okay, back the Shiite militias, because they're fighting ISIS. Who cares if, you know, they're aligned with Iran? It's whatever. Who cares if they're the people that literally fought us when we were doing the war in Iraq, originally under Bush? A lot of the Shiites originally were fighting us. But now it's like, okay, ISIS is worse, so back the Shiites in Iraq to fight ISIS. Okay, so far so good. Cross the border into Syria. Just cross the border into Syria. We flip sides. There we go. No, we hate Bashar Assad so much, who's the Shiite Alawite leader in Syria, that we are going to fund, allegedly, moderate Sunnis who aren't moderate. They're Islamists and jihadists, as we've shown and demonstrated on the show before. But we're going to fund them. We're going to fund the Sunnis to fight the Shias. So wait, you move just a couple miles from this area to that area, and we flip sides in the conflict. We're on the side of the Shiites in Iraq. We're on the side of the Sunnis in Syria. They're right fucking next to each other. And honestly, they're part of the same broader conflict. Because like we said time and time again, Syria and Iraq are basically fake countries. So in their mind, there's no borders to a lot of the people who are fighting in this. They just think it's a broader Sunni-Shia war. And in one area, we back the Shias, and the other area, we back the Sunnis. But see, that's the problem, is that just doesn't make any sense. It's not like, you know, oh, it's a liberal conspiracy theory, fucking softy pussy over here who doesn't want to get his hands dirty and do the right thing. No, my argument is we're not doing the right thing. We can't be, because by definition, we're on both sides of the fight. That's ridiculous. And then when you broaden the map out further, you see the bigger problems. I mean, Yemen, again, we flip sides again when we go to Yemen. In Syria, we back the Sunnis. In Syria, we back the Sunnis. See, I get confused because we're flipping sides so much. In Syria, we back the Sunnis. In Iraq, we back the Shias. In Yemen, we back the Sunnis. And when the Houthi militants, so the Shiite militants took over in Yemen recently and knocked out the Sunni government, we were screaming, oh my God, terrorism, this, that, all these problems with it. And then at the same time we're screaming about that there, we're giving a pat on the ass to the Shiite militias fighting ISIS in Iraq. So when you talk to, you know, the Shiite militias in Iraq, as Vice has done and others have done, they have these things that sound like conspiracy theories, like, you know, we're against the Americans. I mean, I don't know what they're talking about. They think they're on our side, and so we're against them, they're against us. What do they mean? And, you know, it looks like, oh, conspiracy. Like, no, we're with you. We're fighting ISIS. ISIS is worse. No, but we are on both sides of the conflict. We are also their enemy. So it's just we don't know what the fuck we're doing. It's that simple. And there are all these other motivations that go into it. So the real reason why we're so opposed to Assad in Syria is because Assad is aligned with Russia and Iran. And those two are vying for regional dominance. And the U.S. looks at this as a global chessboard with the same Cold War dynamic that we've had in mind since the Cold War, where we want to contain Russia and we want to make sure that we keep tabs on Iran because, ooh, they're not totally with us like the Saudis are totally with us, even though, by the way, the Saudi government is fucking crazy and they believe in, you know, Salafi Islam. So we're not viewing this through the realm of who really are the good guys, who really are the bad guys, what's actually happening here. Let's talk about altruism, human rights, and stuff like that. Like many naive people think we're looking at it through that prism. We're looking at it through the prism of, you know, how can we, the U.S., continue to have more power, more control, our hand on the natural resources? How can we continue to be the imperialist power? And it's all this geopolitical game, this chessboard. And unfortunately, as a result of that, you can see how our strategy is just beyond absurd, to the point where we're on both sides at the same time. It doesn't make any sense. Obama thinks he's some liberal lion and a leader who's standing up for the right things. No, unless you get the fuck out of these regions and stop doing this bullshit, you're no such thing. I could have broadened that out too further, by the way. Because then when you add Turkey into the conversation, if you're not already facepalming, you would have been facepalming. Because in Turkey, we love the Kurds so much that we arm the Kurds when the Kurds decide they're going to fight ISIS. But Turkey's also our top ally, and Turkey views the PKK, who are Kurdish militants, as a terrorist group. So when we align ourselves with the Kurds, we piss off the Turks. And we're trying to balance that one out too, where how much can we back the Kurds who are fighting ISIS without pissing off Turkey, who's not really fighting ISIS, but they pretend like they're fighting ISIS when they really want to fight the Kurds. It's such a giant fucking mess. It's such a giant fucking mess. And by the way, nobody's talking about it like this. You know, and I'm not patting myself on the back here and saying I'm doing it justice, because I'm not, but every single fucking anchor on CNN and MSNBC and all these different networks should be able to tell you the same shit I'm telling you right now, but they can't, because they don't know dick. And I fear that even people in the government don't know this basic shit that I'm talking about right now. And people say, oh, how do you know this? Believe me, it's not that I'm some sort of fucking genius. It's that I read the news on a daily basis, because it's one of the things I obviously have to do for the show. And when you follow the news for, what, 5 years or more every day straight, you just pick up on exactly what's happening. You piece it together and you go, oh, I see exactly how this works. But our policy is so fucking stupid now that we've literally considered backing Al-Qaeda. I know you roll a lot of people who don't know shit about this fight. They roll their eyes and they're like, what? that's crazy. No, that's right. It is crazy. Go check my Twitter feed. I was tweeting it earlier. David Petraeus, of all people, in the top-level meetings with the Obama administration, would float the idea, hey, how about we back Al-Qaeda to beat ISIS? How about that? This is what this guy thinks, and this is an idea that was taken seriously. But no, we were able to back off of that, thank goodness. But what did we settle for? Don't arm Al-Qaeda. Arm the other Islamists who are fighting against Assad. Oh, for fuck's sake, man. For fuck's sake. It's like a bad dream, and we never learn our lesson. How many times has the U.S. armed people, and then immediately the people we arm do the most horrific crimes with it? Let's just not arm them. How about that crazy idea? How about that crazy idea? All right, I got to take a break now. When we come back, I want to get into this new hospital bombing in Yemen. Then I want to get into some stuff about the crazy healthcare system we have. And a right-wing radio host, Michael Savage, gave us an adorable conspiracy theory that I can't wait to talk about. All right, stay right there, guys.
Of a bitch. All right, we're back.
Unfortunately, it happened again. There was another hospital that was bombed, this time in Yemen. Reuters reports, quote, a Yemeni hospital run by Doctors Without Borders was bombed in a Saudi-led airstrike, wrecking the facility and wounding several people. A Saudi-led Arab coalition intervened in Yemen's civil war in March to try to restore its government after its toppling by Houthi forces, but the civilian death toll has escalated since then, alarming the United Nations and human rights groups. Quote, the facility in Sada'a, which is North Yemen, was hit by several airstrikes last night with patients and staff inside the facility. The air raids resulted in the destruction of the entire hospital with all that was inside, devices and medical supplies, and the moderate wounding of several people. And they say other airstrikes hit a nearby girls' school and damaged several civilian homes. Now, Reuters goes on to explain that they haven't verified this yet, but the information as of right now is what I just reported to you here. And then they go on to give more facts about the fighting in Yemen, and they say that over 5,000 people are dead, and over 50% of the people who have been killed are civilians. Now, last time we discussed this, I believe it was in reference to the UN and the fact that I believe it was France was calling for an investigation into the bombing in Yemen to try to figure out more specifically what's happening and look at the civilian death rate in detail and get into all the nuance of it. And the United States and Saudi Arabia blocked it. So Saudi Arabia is carrying out the bombing, and the U.S. is, of course, providing the weaponry and sometimes giving logistical support where they say, okay, here's where you bomb and here's where you bomb. So we blocked it because don't you dare ever try to do an investigation into our crimes, because our crimes don't count because we're the good guys. So what's the end result? Stuff like this. Now, when we discussed the bombing of the facility in Kunduz, immediately there were a bunch of people who, you know, came out and said, well, I mean, this has to be an accident. I mean, the U.S. and our allies, we don't bomb hospitals. Well, first of all, that's not true, because we've detailed five other occasions from the 1990s until today where, indeed, we did do it. Now, if you mess up once or twice or maybe even three times, okay, I get it. Shit happens. But when you five times up until recently and then two times since then, and let's be fair and say this one, let's blame this one solely on Saudi Arabia, even though we don't know all the details of it, okay? But six times in a time span from the 1990s until today, it looks to me like you're more open to it depending on the circumstance. And unfortunately, sometimes the circumstance is not the kind of circumstance where any person might say, go ahead and do it. Like, for example, as they lay out in international law, if you have, you know, some sort of militant terrorist group that has taken over all of a hospital and they're literally firing on people from the hospital, that's like the only time where people say, okay, you may do it. We learned in Kunduz is that between 22 and 30 people died, virtually all civilians. Now, the reports that came out afterwards, first of all, the U.S. government has changed their story like 100 times on this. Every other day they come out with, well, what happened was this, what happened was that, what happened was this. And all we know is the hardcore facts here, that it's 22 to 30 civilians who were killed, and we have the cockpit recordings from the bombing where they say to each other, isn't this a hospital? And then they proceed to bomb it anyway. Now, we don't know if it was the Afghan forces on the ground who said, we need you to go bomb this target, or if it was our guys who told our other guys who were doing the bombing, hey, you need to go hit this target. But either way, you're fucking responsible. And naturally, the U.S. has been blocking an investigation into this as well. So, again, whenever we do it, www.shh.com, because we're the good guys, so shut the fuck up. And if we happen to do something wrong, you'll get over it. In essence, is what they're saying here. But guys, this all goes back to the intentions argument, and I've laid out before, I think it's a spectrum. It's not just your intentions are good or your intentions are bad. There's plenty of area in the middle of that spectrum where it's very murky. So if you're only trying to kill a Taliban guy or an Al-Qaeda guy and an ISIS guy, and you happen to get one civilian, but you killed like nine Taliban guys, that's one thing, and you're morally culpable to a certain extent if you do that. But what we're talking about in the situation in Kunduz is you got virtually all civilians, maybe no Taliban people, but let's be kind and say you got a couple Taliban people, and it appears as if it was a decision that was made to do it. So think about that. We've made the decision, and even if you separate Kunduz from this and get rid of that and just use other examples that we know of as a matter of fact, where we bomb funerals of Taliban operatives. We look at it, we go, okay, we might get a couple of Taliban guys, but we know we're going to kill women and children as well. Bomb anyway. Again, we've done that. This has been reported on. This is all a matter of record. Well, that's not just collateral damage. That's something much worse than collateral damage, and that most certainly is a war crime. We don't get a pass because we're us, and we think by definition we mean well, so piss off. No, and this is why when you look at well-respected polling agencies, when they ask people all around the world which government is the biggest threat to world peace, the answer is always, by a mile and a half, the United States of America. I don't think that literally everybody else is crazy and we're the only ones that got our shit down here when you talk to Americans. I think, unfortunately, Americans are ignorant and they're kept in the dark about a lot of the shit that goes on around the world in their name. Now, again, the Yemeni situation here is a little bit different, because we don't know all the details yet, and this stuff can change completely. I mean, it's possible that we pointed out on the map where to hit, and they hit. It's possible that the Saudi Arabian government made all the decisions on their own, and, you know, we're just arming them and repeatedly arming them even after they've killed over 50% civilians. Or it's possible that this is an example where just all the facts are wrong, and it's indeed not true that we hit another Doctors Without Borders hospital. We don't know for sure yet, but either way, given the track record with all these different separate cases, what we can take away from this is it's time to largely disengage from the world in terms of military interventions. I get it. Whenever there's a direct threat against us, I'll be the first one calling for force. I'm not a pacifist. I'm a non-interventionist. There's a big difference. It's okay to use force in self-defense. I also get it. If there's an out-and-out genocide happening somewhere, I'm totally fine with, and I would be in favor of acting quickly if the UN gets involved and we all go to attack the problem together and we stop it. But right now, that's not what's happening. What's happening is the U.S. is involved in 7 different countries militarily at least, whether it's drone wars or airstrikes or just flat out having troops on the ground. And that's not making anything better. In fact, empirically, it's making it worse. Since we started the war on terror, there's been a net creation of more terrorists. That's not all the U.S.'s fault, but a lot of our mistakes have killed civilians and created more terrorists as a result of this. And when we look at what happened in Kunduz, the idea that we should stay in Afghanistan is honestly laughable. You know, what do we need to do? Oh, my God, we need to stay there because it's so dangerous if we're not there. If we're not there, who's going to stop crazy people from bombing the hospitals in Afghanistan? Wait, what? What? That doesn't make much sense, does it? And we also need to just stop arming regimes that we know are full of fucking crazy people, like the Salafist government in Saudi Arabia, who we always arm with a smile on our fucking face because they're our oil butt buddy and we're partners in crime. I mean, this is a government that has the same ideology as ISIS. They behead drug smugglers. They behead people for apostasy. They behead people for the most ridiculous crimes. They imprisoned somebody the other day because the person dared to have a liberal interpretation of Islam and to argue for it. And these are the people we want to align ourselves with? No, that shows that intentions are not just good or bad. It's much more murky than that. There's a spectrum of intentions, and I'm not going to excuse it when we arm Islamist rebels in Syria or when we arm the Mujahideen, as we did under Ronald Reagan in Afghanistan, because they were fighting the big bad Soviet Union. I'm not going to excuse it when we arm Saudi Arabia and sometimes help them bomb targets that end up being civilian targets. I'm not going to excuse it when we bomb hospitals in Afghanistan and then brush it off and stop any investigation from happening. No, it's time to be responsible. Take responsibility for your actions so we prevent it from happening again in the future. All right, let's go to my buddy David Pakman here. The David Pakman Show covered a fascinating story about Big Pharma fail. Let me try that again. I love when I can't read my own shit. The David Pakman Show covered a really interesting story about a big pharma CEO who let it all hang out about the way that the system really works.
Let me tell you a little story about a pharmaceutical CEO admitting the reality that their business is profit, not helping sick people. I'm not talking about Martin Shkreli. I'm talking about J. Michael Pearson, who's the CEO of Valeant Pharmaceuticals. Ring of Fire has turned their attention to this guy in the wake of the Martin Shkreli price gouging. Pearson's company is not in the business of curing disease. They're not in the business of easing suffering. They exist to make money for their shareholders, which the CEO acknowledges. He said, quote, "If products are sort of mispriced and there's an opportunity, we will act appropriately in terms of doing what I assume our shareholders would like us to do." Acting appropriately has apparently led to Valeant raising the prices on several drugs this year, in some cases as much as 800%. How are they justifying those price increases? They say they're, quote, "setting their prices on a range of factors, including clinical benefits and the value they bring to patients, physicians, payers, and society." There's also a stated concern about potential competition from generic versions that may come onto the market in coming months. Pearson is absolutely right, Lewis. He is just the messenger here. He is just stating the reality, which is a system where healthcare and medication are a for-profit business is a system that does not prioritize people's health. We knew that. He's just admitting what was so obvious to us.
Yeah, that's 100% correct, and that's an issue, and that's a point that oftentimes, unfortunately, I think some liberals miss. So in other words, you don't blame necessarily the individual, you blame the system. And when people are working within a system where the whole premise of the system is fucked up, it's not necessarily that we're dealing with bad people, it's that we're dealing with a perverse incentive structure that can lead otherwise good people to do bad things. And this goes for a bunch of different areas, too. Even when you talk about cops, do I think that the majority of cops are just bad people who are all racist at their core and, you know, they act out on these evil impulses? No, that's like a caricature of what's actually happening. What's happening is, unfortunately, they're functioning in a system that gives them the green light and incentivizes them to do the war on drugs, for example, which is like the new Jim Crow, which disproportionately targets minority communities. They're functioning within systems that may allow them or push them in the direction of doing stop and frisk, and they always go to poor minority communities to end up doing it. So the problem there is the system. They shouldn't be allowed to lock people up for doing drugs in the first place, so they shouldn't have the green light to search people. They should only be focusing on violent crime. They should only be focusing on rape and assault and murder and shit like that. So the problem is the way we've set the system up, not necessarily that the individuals themselves are bad people, even though occasionally, sure, we do have occasional bad actor, no doubt about it. And even with money and politics, you see this problem. It's not that, everybody who's in Congress right now, they're just all the scum of the earth. And if we just replaced all of them and go picked random people from Iowa and Idaho and Wisconsin and Hawaii that, ooh, look, now it's functioning so much better. No, because the people get their moral code and their ethics chipped away at by the way the system works. The system rewards you if you go and raise money from special interests and corporations and you do their bidding. So even if you take good people and put them in that situation, maybe 1% of them will be able to override the bad incentive structure, somebody like a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or Alan Grayson. But the overwhelming majority of them, even if they're good people, like, good run-of-the-mill normal Democrats, it's easy for them to fall into the trap and become establishment corporatist Democrats because of the way the system is geared and what it rewards. And it's the same thing with what David's talking about here, which is the pharmaceutical company, the health insurance companies, the health care companies. In the U.S., we've set it up so that most of the system is private and for-profit. Well, by definition, under that system, you're only going to care, or you're going to care first and foremost about, how do I pad the bottom line? I have a fiduciary responsibility to my shareholders to make money. I need to make money. This is why we're in this business. So by any means necessary, we have to meet that goal. And the problem is the way that system is structured. You need to incentivize doctors, for example, to actually want to fucking treat people and make them better, not incentivize them to stay on pills and, you know, keep coming back to them or something like that. Same thing with the pharmaceutical companies. You want to incentivize them to actually find cures so that we fix problems, as opposed to incentivizing them to just keep making more money. So you want to create things that aren't a cure, but it's somewhere in the middle where you got to keep coming back to me to get your fix. So, and this is where the role of government comes in, because I'm one of those guys, everybody already knows, I think there are some areas where, yes, the profit motive in capitalism makes sense. Consumer products, video games, cars, couches. I don't want the government making that. In fact, I think empirically it's been proven that they suck at making stuff like that. But do I want the government involved in health care, health insurance, the pharmaceutical industry, education? Absolutely. The profit motive has shown it is horrendous in those areas. So we need to be rational about how we prioritize and how we set up the system. And we don't necessarily need to blame the individuals. We need to collectively fix the system and make it so that good people can act in a good way and they're not incentivized to act in a bad way. All right, next. My favorite story of the day. I just fucking said it. Did you hear me? You want me to say it again? My favorite story of the day is coming up right now. So extremist right-wing radio host Michael Savage recently did a Bernie Sanders impression on air. He has roughly 12 listeners, so I'm sure that like 3 of the 12 thought it was funny. And here he's going to get jealous, and he's jealous about Larry David's impression of Bernie Sanders on Saturday Night Live. And he's going to go off on this awesome, awkward, conspiratorial rant where he tells you what SNL is really up to and why they're doing what they're doing. Michael, take it away.
Now you understand why ISIL or ISIS or the Islamic fascists are raging across the globe, why Obama gets away with virtual murder and printing money. It's because of a little help from his friends. See, the 60s had a song by the Beatles called I Get By With a Little Help From My Friends, I Get High With a Little Help From My Friends, and nothing's really changed. They get by with a little help from their friends, they get high with a little help from their friends, which leads us to Saturday Night Live, a stoner channel. And there's a comedian who you have probably never heard of, a snide Brooklyn billionaire socialist named Larry David. And I was told that this snide billionaire socialist Larry David did a Bernie Sanders imitation this past weekend. Now, being a political left-wing fanatic like Sanders himself, David cleverly chose not to ridicule Sanders' politics. You know, he did weak jokes about underwear and radiators, that kind of thing. Now, the reason Saturday Night Live made believe that they were ridiculing Bernie Sanders was to weaken Michael Savage's strong performance, where not only is Bernie Sanders the lunatic ridiculed, but more particularly Bernie Sanders' more insane Soviet economics are exposed through my comedy. Now, you have to hand it to the extreme liberal media types. When they see a genuine threat emerge on the other side in the form of someone who is as talented as I am, and they take on one of their cultural icons, you see, they bring in their biggest guns to try and triangulate the opposition, just what Hillary Clinton's been doing. Question, did anyone see the Saturday Night Live imitation of Sanders? Who was better, me or Larry David? And did you notice how they never entertained or ridiculed his Soviet-style politics? Yes, we will talk about that. But the bigger topic is this. It's the surge of Muslims into Europe and the United States of America. The migrant influx threatens to drown the world and drag us into 1,000 years of darkness. My friends, if you want Sharia law, then listen to Saturday Night Live while stoned on marijuana. If you think you're just smoking a J and having a good night, you don't understand that they've been brain deadening you for years.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's so much fun. He goes on to explain, it's a much longer segment, where he goes on to explain what SNL is doing is they're brainwashing everybody and trying to get them high and trying to get them lazy and stuff so that they can then turn around and bring in all the ISIS people and implement Sharia law here. Oh my God, this guy is an absolute lunatic. No, I'm not kidding when I say that he probably should be on psychiatric drugs if he's not already. You know, this guy needs Seroquel, this guy needs Thorazine, this guy needs some sort of thing to keep him balanced. Listen to what he's saying. And I don't doubt for a second that he believes it. You know how some right-wing commentators we think, are they acting or are they true believers? With this guy, I think he's a true believer, and he's just simply off his rocker. This is the guy who said, I don't believe in autism. I think autism is a conspiracy so that people try to get money from the government. This is the guy who said we should just nuke and kill millions of Muslims. In any Muslim country, just nuke and kill. That's what we should do. Well, civilians, grandmas, mothers, children, just nuke them. Fuck them. That's what this guy said. Listen to this. Listen to this. SNL. SNL. SNL is on the side with fundamentalist Muslims who want to implement Sharia. SNL is with ISIS. I didn't say it. He said it. He's the one who said it. Because every time I do one of these segments, people, you know, sometimes they say, oh, you're strawmanning or you're extrapolating too far. No. You just heard him say it. I'll provide a link in the video description box. You can hear the entire segment. You can hear everything. Right Wing Watch shows the multiple parts of it. Go ahead, listen to all of it. It's perfectly clear what he's saying. He thinks SNL secretly wants to implement Sharia. And I love it. She's just tying random shit together. Their Bernie Sanders impression was worse than mine. I love how jealous he is. It was worse than mine, and that's why they want Sharia. What the fuck are you talking about? Even if I grant you your first part of the argument, which I do not, the takeaway is not the second part of the argument. If I grant you the first part of their argument, that, ooh, they're going soft on Bernie's Soviet-style communism, well, then wouldn't that mean they want Soviet-style communism? And communism is vehemently anti-religion, to the point of not even being secular, where you have freedom of religion, but the government is neutral. It's secularism. No, in the Soviet Union, they forcibly removed religion, like with guns and stuff. So that would be the opposite of Sharia. What the fuck are you saying, man? And then that obviously also is not true. They're going soft on Bernie's communism. Well, perhaps he's not a fucking communist, and you don't know shit about political science. How many times have we gone over this? He's a social democrat, which means that he looks at Scandinavia and he goes, I think they got it right. A mix of capitalism and socialism, where certain things are run by the government, healthcare, education, and stuff like that, and other things are not. It's a free market in other respects. Communism, Stalin, Soviet Union. Clearly, SNL is sympathetic to communism because they want to implement Sharia law. No, but this shows you, man. They make it up as they go along. They make it up as they go along. You know, he's not connected to facts, not connected to reality. He certainly doesn't read the news. Whatever theory he pulls out of his rectum is the one that he runs with. And people wonder, like, oh, I can't, AM radio, why is it going out of style? Other than the fact that it's AM fucking radio, this is the fucking garbage that's on it. Who listens to that and goes, I think he's got it? Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. SNL made fun of the Democratic debate because they want Sharia law. And I love the part where he's like, whenever they hear people as talented as I am, on the other side they have to break out the big guns. He really thinks the people at SNL like listen to his impression of Bernie Sanders, and they're like, ah, the right winger did a good impression. We got to get our biggest guns. Bring out Larry David. No, that's not true. I bet you nobody fucking heard your thing except your very few fans who are about 82 years old. It's so insecure as talent. Here's when people say, there's nobody's as talented as I am. You know who says that? People who are totally insecure about their own abilities. Because you don't need to say it if it's true. Why do you need to say something like that? And the way he says it, too, it's not just like a thing where he really is just throwing it out there. It's like, you know, thought of, and I need to say that I'm great because nobody else does, because I'm not great. I suck at what I do. Yeah, we can see that, man. It's really sad. Maybe you should try not making shit up, and then your show would get better. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, the Associated Press is reporting on another major, major issue happening with climate change, and I got a whole bunch of stuff. You don't want to miss it. Pat Robertson's in there. Stay right there, guys.
Young girls, they do get weary wearing that same old shaggy dress, yeah, yeah. But when she gets weary, try a little tenderness, yeah. You know she's waiting, yep, and just awaiting a thing that she'll never, 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 never forget. While she's there waiting, without them, try a little tenderness. It's not just sentimental, no, no, no. She had her grief and care, yeah, yeah, yeah. But the soft words, they are spoke so gentle, yeah.
Guys, let's get scared together. How does that sound? The Associated Press is reporting on another mind-blowing symptom of climate change. A new study in the journal Nature says, quote, carbon dioxide emissions continue at their current pace. By the end of the century, parts of the Persian Gulf will sometimes be too hot for the human body to tolerate. How hot? The heat index, which combines heat and humidity, may hit 165 to 170 degrees. That's so hot that the human body can't get rid of the heat. The elderly and ill are hurt most by current heat waves, but the future is expected to be so hot that healthy, fit people would be endangered, health experts say. All right. That's incredible. Now, they go on to say that obviously it's not, you know, 24 hours a day or whatever. It's for, I think, 6 to 7 hours midday at times, certain times of the year or whatever. But this is somewhat unprecedented, and it's directly because of the greenhouse effect and directly because of climate change. Guys, that's not that far away. Like, oftentimes when we discuss climate change, or when we used to discuss climate change, it was this thing that we talk about as if, you know, great-great-grandkids around that time, that's when they'll start to see the beginning of all the problems. No, I think the problems are happening right now, whether you look at the increase in wildfires in the Midwest and the West in the United States, and I'm sure elsewhere, whether you look at the increase in other kinds of natural disasters, whether you look at the increase in drought and stuff like that. It's happening already, and time that we act on it, but I feel like no matter what the fuck happens, we can't get our shit together enough, and we can't get the world on board enough, or even our own government, where we treat the problem for what it is, and we really move in a different direction when it comes to our energy source. Now, I always find it hilarious when people on the right argue that, you know, this is going to hurt the economy, and we got to be practical, and that's why we can't do dick about it. No, 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 no. If anything, the opposite will happen. If we have a green technology boom and we have to redo the infrastructure in all countries with green technology and renewable energy, there's going to be nothing but economic upsides to that. How do you not see that? This entire blossoming new industry that we need to implement in all these different places, obviously there's tremendous upsides. Obviously many jobs are going to be created. Obviously it'll help with wealth creation. This idea that, you know, oh, since we have to move off of the old guard, it's a problem because it just is whenever you move off the old guard. I mean, that's like saying we got to stick with horse and buggies and fuck the cars. You know, oh, hey, man, but there's so many people whose jobs are tied to the horse and buggy, and we're so used to it. And, I mean, what, should we have stuck with the landline when the cell phone came along? And should we have stuck with the Saved by the Bell Zach Morris fucking brick phone when they came along with the flip phone? And should we have stuck with the flip phone when they came along with the newer smartphones? It just... there's no argument for it. And the only people making those arguments are people that are bought off by the oil companies and the fossil fuel companies, or people who are just ignorant and useful idiots. And I feel like no matter how many times I report the most incredible stories, we still don't move quickly enough down the right road on this. And it's not an excuse anymore to say, oh, but India and but China. I mean, what kind of a fucking... so if they randomly legalized murder, what would that... we'd say, oh, I mean, what are we going to do? India, China, they murder. We got to murder. They murder. India, China. That doesn't mean anything. It's fucking... the Charlie Brown shit is what I hear when people say shit like that. No, we know that we have a tremendous problem here. We know we have the ability to do the right thing, if we just put our mind to it and get the money out of politics and end the corruption and the fossil fuel industry having its tentacles on everybody. So it's time to fucking do it. They're saying by 2100, no matter what we do now, parts of the Persian Gulf, uninhabitable. Uninhabitable. I mean, good, you have AC, so maybe you won't die immediately, but imagine some places where people are living and the AC goes out, you're just going to die. You're just going to die. This is what we're talking about. It's already pretty fucking hot there. They're saying it's going to get hotter. We'll see, man. How many more stories do we have to do? Whether it's the trillions of dollars that the cleanup from climate change will cost, or whether it's other things. No matter how outrageous or incredible or unbelievable the facts are, we drag our feet. Let's stop dragging our feet and let's do the right thing, because we have to do it. All right, let's go to Pat Robertson. Pat Robertson is going to do some awesome judicial revisionism here. Let's watch.
Sherry says, I recently saw a letter written to the editor of our local newspaper by a young college student
He claims that Romans 13:1-4 clearly supports the Supreme Court gay marriage decision. He writes, since the Bible says that government is from God, therefore everyone must submit to the government, even Christians, these verses will not only shut up the bigots, but will settle this argument once and for all. Using the Bible this way to validate their sinful lifestyle not only contradicts what God said about homosexuality, but is downright blasphemous. I want to respond, but how do I reply in a benevolent manner where I can show and correct him without sounding malicious or condescending?
Well, you get condescending and you say, look, he's wrong. I mean, that's how you start. You can't have people misinterpreting the Bible. The Bible, first of all, the government. The Supreme Court has issued a ruling. That ruling, I tell you what, in the legal system, Party A sues Party B over marriage. I want to get married to them. And the court says, okay, you can get married. That doesn't mean that I've got to get married to a homosexual. It doesn't mean that you have to, nor does it mean that it's the law of the land. Congress didn't pass any law. Your state legislature didn't pass a law. So you're not under anything. It's a decision of the court having to do with a couple of people.
Oh, that was so precious. That was so precious. Just because they allow gay marriage in one case doesn't mean that I don't have to marry a homosexual and you don't have to marry a homosexual. I know, Pat. Nobody ever said you do have to marry a homosexual. Nobody ever said that anybody else does. It just gives people the option if they want to. Giant straw man. Resurrect it. Resurrect it. Okay, good. Slap it down. What liberal said... Hello, they just passed gay marriage. Are you going to blow John or what? He's waiting. Look, Pat, his dick's out. Go. What are you waiting for? Nobody ever said that. Nobody ever said that. But then he notice how he goes from straw man, to what actually is the case and what he actually does need to abide by. He's like, well, I don't have to marry a homosexual, but just because the court said that two gay people can get married doesn't mean it's the law of the land now. Oh, yes, it does. On that one, you're dead wrong. It absolutely does. No, see, notice what they do. Whenever Congress or different state laws line up more with their ideology, what do they say? The only thing that matters is Congress and the state laws. Supreme Court is irrelevant. That doesn't count. What do you mean? But whenever it's the opposite, what do? They do that in reverse. The Congress and state laws don't count because the Supreme Court agreed with me on this one, so Supreme Court's right, law of the land. So it just all goes based off whatever their opinion is. Whatever their opinion is, they'll rationalize it by just saying, the system works in this way, and they don't even realize that they're contradicting themselves for other cases. Now, and also, dude, it's the most obvious thing ever. This is the argument Rick Santorum's been using also against gay marriage, where he says, this is judicial supremacy. Don't they know we have checks and balances here? And what the fucking moron doesn't get is this was a case of doing checks and balances. This isn't judicial supremacy. This is judicial review. This is part of checks and balances. If the country is acting in a way that is unconstitutional, and we've had that in place for a long time, and then it gets to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, no, no, this is wrong. This is the interpretation of the Constitution that makes sense. This is now the law of the land. This is now what is constitutional. You don't just get to say, well, I disagree. I'm going to override it, and I'll point to something that's lower than the Supreme Court to back up my case, because then you just don't know how the United States government works. And guys, understand, we don't do this. Like, the left doesn't do this. How many times have I said, when you talk about money in politics, for example, I'll give you the cases. I'll say McCutcheon, I'll say Citizens United, I'll say Buckley versus Vallejo, and I'll mention all the cases. And I'll say, look, they ruled this. I disagree with it. I think they have misinterpreted the Constitution. But I accept the reality, so what we need to do is try to get a new constitutional amendment to override it. I don't just say, let's do nothing, but insist that it's of course, our side that won when we didn't win, when that's not true. So we accept the reality and we move on from it and say we need to fight to change it because we think they misinterpreted it. He's just saying, Supreme Court irrelevant. Doesn't matter, it doesn't count because they disagreed with me on this issue, so therefore just because they say it's the law of the land doesn't mean it's the law of the land. Of course it does. Not only does it mean it's the law of the land, it's bigger than that. It means it is constitutional. It is constitutionally correct, and for you to do the opposite, you are acting in an unconstitutional way, and you're not allowed to do that. And the Constitution supersedes law. So he's just a fundamental misunderstanding here. But it's not even about whether or not he understands it. He's just using any argument to try to back up his case that I don't want the gays to get married. Well, why don't you go a step further, buddy? Because remember, in the Bible, they ban interracial marriage between tribes and religions. So that's interpreted as between races and religions. Well, if you really want to implement biblical law and that's what you care about and that's your standard, where are you, Pat? I'm waiting. Let me hear it. You want to ban interracial marriage too? Unless you don't believe in the Bible. And if you don't believe in the Bible, I guess you're a bad Christian, aren't you? It's always whatever's politically convenient for them. That's the argument they'll make. And when he says, you know, when somebody says it's okay to have gay marriage biblically, they're misinterpreting the Bible. That may be true because it's clear in Leviticus, man shall not lie with the man. Same thing with interracial marriage as I just laid out for you. That's also banned. Are you going to fight for that? But let's go a step further here. You really believe in biblical law. You really believe in interpreting the Bible properly. As far as I can tell, there's two issues where there's no two sides in the Bible. Most things are wildly contradictory. But when it comes to the issue of immigration and when it comes to the issue of economics, the Bible's crystal clear. Jesus is a fucking Marxist before Marxism was a thing. On immigration, you got to treat them just as well as your family and your friends and your neighbors. You got to open up your door and let them in. So I know that Pat Robertson is out there working right now to set up a campaign to get all the Syrian refugees to come to America. Right, buddy? All right, now, what else I got here? I got two more religion ones. All right, Ken Ham. Creationist lunatic Ken Ham launched attacks on Bill Nye, who, of course, he previously debated, and this time it wasn't over evolution. The original debate they had was on evolution. This was over climate change. So here's what Ken Ham wrote in his blog. Quote, "We don't need to be concerned about drastic climate change." Of course not. "Our climate and the checks and balances that keep it operating within safe parameters were designed by an all-wise creator. We certainly need to make sure we don't fill our atmosphere with pollutants or punch holes in the ozone layer, but we also need to remember that our atmosphere was carefully placed by our creator. God knew exactly what kind of atmosphere we needed, and he gave us that atmosphere." He continues, "Does he realize that from his atheistic perspective," talking about Bill Nye now, "man is just an evolved animal, and in being consistent with an evolutionary survival of the fittest worldview, population alarmists could suggest mass killings or forced sterilizations as possible solutions in reducing the population. I'm sure he would be aghast at such suggestions, but then on what basis, does he anchor his morality and determine what is ultimately right and wrong in this world?" All right, I love how dumb he is, because he just makes shit up. He's like, "Oh, you're an atheist? Well, then, I guess you must believe in mass killings or forced sterilizations. And if you don't believe in it, well, by what basis do you not believe in it?" Gotcha! You gotta believe in it, because you're an atheist. Except we don't, and instead of strawmanning us and tap dancing here, you just fucking ask us what we believe in. Go ahead, ask him. I like how he admits, like, Bill Nye would disagree with this, but I'm going to tell you what he believes anyway, or what he has to believe because he's an atheist. Or how about you don't do that? There's a crazy idea. There's a wacky one. Now, how ridiculous is this guy? So, as somebody who's an atheist, when I think of morality, I think of the golden rule. Now, he would turn around and say, "Aha, see, you have a Christian basis for your morality." No, the golden rule way predates Christianity. The idea that you should treat others as you would like to be treated, that's not a radical thing. It's a logical thing. If you sit down and think about morality and ethics for 5 minutes, that's as close as you can get to something that's like a universal truism. So I'm able to think that hey, I don't want anybody punching me in the face. I don't want anybody killing me. I don't want anybody raping me. I don't want anybody taking the shit that belongs to me. Therefore, why would I ever do that to somebody else if I view other people as basically the same as me or equal to me, another human with thoughts and feelings and emotions and families and friends? Like, it's not hard to come to this conclusion, but he just resurrects this giant straw man, or resurrects is not the right word, but you know what I'm saying. And he pretends like, well, since Bill Nye is an atheist, he's got to believe in mass killing. He's got to believe in forced sterilizations because climate change is so bad that we need to do those things. But that, I don't even see the fucking connection there. What are you talking about? All we would need to do is the shit that we're saying we should do, which is turn to renewable energy and green technology. We've said that for so long now. That's the answer. You just make up that we want to do fucking mass killings or forced sterilization. Bill Nye wants to do a genocide. Atheists want to do a genocide. Please, man. And I like how the beginning of what he says here is just, it all comes back to God. Everything is just God. We don't need to be concerned about drastic climate change. I love how he just asserts shit like that. We don't need to be concerned. What are you fucking basing that off of? We don't need to be concerned. Our climate and the checks and balances that keep it operating within safe parameters were designed by God. Everything just comes back to God. He's like a walking caricature of a fundamentalist religious guy. Hey, man, I got a fucking toothache, and I don't know what to do about it. Is there any suggestion? God! Praise him! You'll feel better. You don't need to worry about that toothache and all the things that go hand in hand with that because God, an all-wise, all-knowing creator. But you sound like a crazy person because you are a crazy person. You know what the answer is if you have a really bad toothache? Go to the dentist. Hopefully they'll give you some Vicodin. Then you'll feel better. It's not praying. That shit ain't going to work. All right. Let's go to more crazy Christian people. A Christian website that gives advice to couples recently advocated for rape. So the site is biblicalgenderroles.com, and their writer, Larry Solomon, said the following, quote, "Men should not tolerate refusal from their wives. Women who did not like having sex with their husbands should fake it until she makes it. You also need to realize that whether your wife knows it or not, she needs to have sex too. If you don't have sex with your wife at regular intervals, even sometimes when she is not in the mood but consents anyway, you will open yourself to temptation. Focus your eyes on her body, not her face. Focus on the visual pleasures you receive from looking at her body and physical pleasure you receive from being inside your wife. You want to connect with her physically and emotionally during sex, but your wife is the one refusing to connect with you emotionally, so you have to concentrate 100% on the physical side. He says, I know you love your wife. Most men love their wives, but sin is ugly. Your beautiful bride's face becomes ugly during the sinful time that she is grudgingly giving you sex as she grimaces, wanting you to just hurry up and get it over with. So like the men who could not look at Medusa's face, otherwise, they would be killed. Realize that if you look at your wife's face when she is displaying a sinful attitude towards sex, it will kill your sexual pleasure and may actually make it much more difficult for you to achieve the physical connection and release that you need. Sometimes we have to work around the sinful behavior of our wives, not his sinful behavior, the wife's sinful behavior, and this will be one of those times. And then in a column earlier this year, and I think we covered this, Solomon insisted that there was, quote, no such thing as marital rape. A wife, he said, could ask her husband to delay sex for a short period of time, but the request must be done humbly and respectfully and always with the attitude in mind that her body does belong to her husband. Come on, man. What the fuck are we doing? What are we doing? What are we doing? What are we doing? Really? This is the level that we're at? We haven't gotten past this in 2015? Think about how ridiculous that is. So what if your wife is sick? What if you just had a gigantic fight and you're on the way out, you're going to get divorced or some shit? What if she fucking has diarrhea or something? No matter... Oh, you said no? Well, you have 5 minutes, because only reasonable intervals that I decide you can say no for. Do you realize the Pandora's box you're opening when you say shit like that? I mean, look, we know, based on, you know, documented history of rapists, that there are people who, that, like, that's their thing. Like, they do it for the power, they do it for the control, they do it for the domination. And if you're married, let's say a woman's married to somebody like that, they don't even know it, and they're, in this guy's world, there's no such thing as marital rape. The guy can fucking viciously and violently rape his wife and fucking, you know, do physical harm and be the worst you can imagine. And under this guy's logic, well, there's no such thing as marital rape, so I'm going to need you to get the fuck over it. I don't know how anybody can think like this, man. Don't, like, from a human perspective, to all, normal people, wouldn't you read this and go, oh, like, you need help. This is not okay, you know? And actually, my friend Jimmy Dore has, we've spoken about this, and I think he's even spoken about this publicly and stuff, and he said, rape is just, it's so rude. Like, the idea, I could never imagine, do you have any idea? If a woman says no to me when I make sexual advances towards her, I'm flaccid in a split second. Because what am I going to do? How can a human being, how can you be that disconnected from the situation and from reality where you're shut down and it's clear that the person doesn't want that, and then it makes you more, you know, sexually involved and be more aggressive? No, that's crazy, man. And I'm not an unreasonable person. I'm not somebody who says, you know, what, you can't ask twice? What do you, hey, you want to have sex? No, pretty please. If you go past two, I'll take two and then tap out, okay? Don't, please and a pretty please, and then you're done. All right, because you got to respect people's individuality and their personal space, and they have rights. I mean, just because you got married doesn't mean that literally she is property and you can do whatever you want with her. I mean, this is just sheer lunacy now. And all in the name of Christianity. My religion is so great and so holy that it allows me to rape you, and you can shut the fuck up about it. Come on, guys. Come on. Just use common sense. I mean, that's the main thing I want to respond to this crazy person here. I like how he thinks, like, being sinful, being bad, it never applies to him, no. If I rape you, I'm not being sinful. You're being sinful for saying no. Never applies to him. But just use common sense. Be reasonable. Open your mind. Understand how other people are feeling and thinking and acting. And don't ever force yourself on anybody for any reason. We're talking about your wife here. I mean, you would think that somebody would have more respect for their significant other, but apparently not. Ben Fields is a Columbia, South Carolina officer who's worked at various schools, and he was caught being incredibly violent with a teenage girl after she refused to leave class. Let's take a look. Wow, he's body slamming the fuck out of her in the desk, guys. So allegedly, she was told to leave multiple times. She refused and talked back, and then that happened. And other students said that they're scared to death of this guy. He won an award somehow for the last school that he worked at. But unsurprisingly, he also had multiple allegations of excessive force. Shocking, based on that video. They say at least two other allegations of excessive force. He's been placed on leave now after this. Thank goodness. But yeah, that guy needs to be fired, at the very least. Totally fired. Not leave, you know, a half measure. Nope, fire that guy And you might want to look into pressing charges, because you can't have people doing that, man. You know what the problem is? The problem is this guy thinks I am the authority figure. Since I am the authority, I am right. Since I am right, I get to do whatever to keep order, whatever that means. Even if that means he has to act in the most disorderly way possible. No, in the name of keeping order, you'll listen to whatever I say, you'll do whatever I want, and if you don't do it, I have a green light to do whatever the fuck I want against you. Guys, that's a young girl. Imagine for a second this was one of Bush's daughters when she was that age. And that's some black cop who's a Democrat. And this happened. You know, don't you think the right wing would all be up in arms? Look at a fucking vicious assault! Well, what's happening now? Thankfully, people online are talking about it. The story's getting big, and I hope it continues to get bigger and bigger. But it no longer should be the case that only groups like Black Lives Matter come out and talk about this when stuff like this happens. Everybody needs to talk about this, and everybody needs to know this is not acceptable. Okay? We have this problem where whenever somebody is an authority figure, they get way more leeway than anybody else. Now, I understand on some level that makes sense because, hey, they're always dealing with situations like this, and you have to have some level of trust and respect in them because they represent the community and you pay them and all this stuff. So I get it, and this is why juries, by and large, have a higher bar when it comes to cops. You know, if a cop does something fucked up, you really, really got to prove that it was fucked up. But, like, this is one of those cases where I don't see the debate. I don't see it. You got this fucking sauce monkey there. Now, I don't know if he actually did steroids, but he certainly looks like he's jacked the fuck up. Body slamming a little girl who's sitting in a desk. You can't do it. Yes, that's a young girl. Even if that was a young guy, you can't do that. Just because they won't get up? Really? That's how you're going to handle the situation? That's how you're going to handle the situation. I mean, worst case scenario, it really should have been that if this person refuses to get up and leave, I'd rather you do absolutely nothing than that. I'd rather you do nothing. And then eventually when they do get up to leave, because they're human, at some point they're going to leave, they're going to have to eat, they're going to have to go to the bathroom, they're going to have to go home, whatever. Then you say, detention, suspension, whatever the case is. But the way you handled it was the worst way possible. And this guy is genuinely unbalanced. This isn't just about an authority issue, which it is also an authority issue. But this is a person who has psychological problems. Nobody acts like that unless they're fucking unbalanced and they're waiting for an opportunity to use force. And that's exactly what we just saw right there, which is why this guy cannot have any responsibility. You can't have him be an authority figure. You can't have him be in control. You can't have him have power, because we see what he does with the power. He clearly abuses it. All right, I'm out of time. I wanted to squeeze in one more, but I can't. We'll do it tomorrow. It has to do with the Saudi prince. Yet again. All right, guys. I love you to death. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Everybody have a great night. Kisses. Mwah. Peace.